Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. Copyright 2006 by Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. Published by University Press of New England, Lebanon, New Hampshire. In the last episode, Russ Gorman had just been taken into custody in Troy, Alabama. Danny Young and Scott Heracles wanted to go to Alabama to interview him, but Scott Heracles would not fly. Captain Laughlin was dealing with that situation. We resume with Finding Amy on page 159, and this is episode 15. "Okay, Scott." Matt Stewart returns to my office and gives me this bewildered look. "They're staying together," I tell him. "Give me Brian's number again." Lieutenant Brian McDonough is my counterpart in the MSP food chain, a good man, a gentle, graying Irishman with a good sense of humor. I dial. "Brian? Yeah, it's Joe Laughlin." "What the heck? We've got a situation." Matt throws his arms up in disbelief at what I just said and starts turning red again. I'm talking to his boss. But I know Brian and believe we can work on this together. McDonough and I start in. "Look, Brian, I know it doesn't make sense, but we absolutely cannot separate these two. I'm convinced that's the heart of the matter. The critical thing is keeping Danny and Scott together. I'm willing to fight for them to go." "Let them go," I tell him. It gets a bit heated, and I tread water for a few, because now this is technically an MSP case. "My bosses don't care at this point, and we'll send someone else," he says. "Shit, Brian," I tell him, "your bosses didn't know squat till now. They haven't been doing this since 21st of October either, damn it." I am frazzled and mad. "Give me Chick's number." Captain Chick Love is next up in the MSP food chain. "I'll call him next, right now. The clock's running. If these guys are going, they've got prep to do." I give it a beat, then go on, trying to convince him. "Brian, if they stay together, they can and will do it. Pull them apart, and Danny will shut down, and then what? I won't even tell Tommy at this point. Brian, I appeal to your investigative sense. You know what I'm talking about." Joe, I agree," he says. "Hang on. Let me make some calls. Give me 30, and I'll call you back." Matt's got that stare again. "What?" I ask him. "Go tell those guys to plan. But hang on, Matt." 40 minutes later, my pager goes off. I call Brian. "Joe," he says. "They go." I breathe a heavy sigh of relief, even as my headache sings. "Thank you, Brian. I'll keep you up on this. Tell you what, I'll keep Chitwood away from the news." We laugh and hang up. Dan and Scott block my doorway, looking like hopeful kids, Matt's head behind them. "Get your crap and go, guys. I think you're crazy, but go, and don't screw me up on this." I'm about to punch my message button again when Danny says, "We won't let you down, Lieutenant. We won't let Amy down." On Thursday morning, embarking on a crazy journey that typified Young's unstoppable, tank-like nature and Heracles' tireless enthusiasm, the two primary detectives climbed into Heracles' unmarked cruiser and left for Alabama. Everyone else might have thought it was crazy, but they really preferred to drive, welcoming the opportunity to thoroughly discuss the case and plan their approach to Gorman. As the miles flew past, however, Scott Heracles was feeling very lonely. It felt strange and wrong to be heading away from his family so close to Christmas. He learned something interesting about his partner on the trip. Danny Young might be a fine detective, but he had a lousy sense of direction. Twice on the way down, while Heracles was dozing, Danny got lost. As they got closer to Alabama, Heracles began to get excited. Unlike Young, he had never met Gorman. He'd only seen Gorman on video, observing Gorman's arrogance and disrespect. This would be Gorman's first custodial interrogation, as opposed to the voluntary interviews at the Portland Police Department. What they and the Attorney General's office wanted was to lock Gorman into his initial story about dropping Amy off. Both detectives knew that a lot was hanging in the balance. They needed to manipulate Gorman into repeating the story and not let him see that it would be to his advantage to change it. Like the day of the search for Amy's body, with a snowstorm coming, this turned out to be another race against the clock. They wanted to get to Troy in time to interview Gorman before the probation and parole officers returned him to Maine. When they left, they thought they'd have a day with Gorman. As it happened, they arrived at 11 a.m. on Friday to find that the probation officers were scheduled to leave Troy an hour later. Their primary reason for going to Alabama right away was their interest in interviewing Gorman one more time while he was still on home ground, but shaken from his encounter with police. Once he was back in a Maine jail, even though the only crime he was accused of was probation violation, they knew he would lawyer up, and no one would be able to talk with him about Amy St. Laurent. Part of their strategy as well was the element of surprise. If Gorman wasn't expecting to have to deal with them until he was back in Maine, he might be shocked by their sudden appearance. This, in turn, could throw him off balance, and he might inadvertently say things he normally wouldn't. They were also eager to test Gorman's reactions to some of their newly discovered information. Now that they knew many things that only he, or he and their witnesses, could know. In particular, now that the detectives knew about the Westbrook traffic stop, they wanted to see which version of the story he would give about the night Amy disappeared. Would Gorman stick to his earlier story, that he had dropped Amy off at the pavilion, was back in 20 minutes, and stayed in for the rest of the night? Or would he give them the same story he'd been giving his friends and relatives about Sharma and Cook having left with Amy while he stayed home? Given Gorman's demonstrated familiarity with the criminal justice system and the police interrogation process, and based on his prior behavior, they also believed he would be interested in speaking with them to test their knowledge of things. It was a common practice with experienced criminals, with sociopaths. Gorman had engaged in various forms of testing and disinformation throughout the investigation. It would be, the detectives expected, a battle of wits in which their job was to be more clever. Driving like teenagers on a road trip, they left Maine around 9:30 on Thursday morning, reaching South Carolina early Friday morning at 2 o'clock a.m. They slept for 4 hours, leaving around 6 o'clock a.m. with about 4 more hours to drive. They fought their way through the morning snarl of Atlantic traffic and reached Troy with only an hour to spare, an hour they got only because Troy is in another time zone. Troy is a quiet southern town of about 15,000, located about 50 miles from Montgomery, which is home to Troy State University. Although they had a telephone relationship with the Troy Police Department, primarily with Detective Sergeant Callista Everidge, since the initial request for Gorman's records, Young and Heracles had no idea what kind of a reception they would receive. Scott Heracles said that when you go into a situation where you have to lean on other agencies, you never know what you'll get. Often there is a coldness or hesitation. But the reception and support they got in Troy were exceptional. Because time was short, they were quickly provided with an interview room and taping capability. They immediately began taping an interview with Gorman, putting into play their plan to use Heracles as the interviewer. As expected, Gorman didn't want to deal with Danny Young. From the first, he'd known that Young didn't believe him. He tried to get rid of Young and speak with Scott Heracles alone, probably thinking he'd have a better shot at manipulating the younger detective. He couldn't split them up, and the interview proceeded with both detectives, Heracles sitting directly in front of Gorman, with Young sitting behind Heracles. Gorman began the interview as his usual cocky and arrogant self, projecting the attitude he'd exhibited all along. "Oh yeah, you cops don't know anything." Heracles asked Gorman to tell them again about the night he dropped Amy off, and he responded, "I already told you all about that." Heracles said, "Yeah, well, I haven't heard it, so just humor me and tell me what happened." Gorman responded, "You know, I dropped her off and came straight home," and went over the story again. As Gorman talked, Heracles felt the last uneasiness about leaving his family vanish, replaced by excitement. Once they'd gotten him to repeat his story, and had seen that it was unchanged, and that they had him on tape, locked into his lie, in Heracles' words, they took off their gloves and went at him with what they now knew, asking, "Okay, so what about this, and what about that?" challenging his timeline, his lies, his accusations against Jason and Cush. The detectives wanted to see him dance, and they got what they wanted. Suddenly, Gorman, the cocky loudmouth, the born manipulator, the slick liar, began to come apart. When Heracles asked what Gorman had to say about telling Jamie that his roommates had killed Amy, Gorman's eyes widened, and he abandoned his arrogant slouch, looking like he'd seen a ghost. He told investigators, "I think I need an attorney." Since it was now legally a case with custody and interrogation, the investigators had to stop asking questions. But Heracles told Gorman, "No more questions, okay, but I'm going to talk, and you're going to listen." Then he laid out what they had and told Gorman he was going down. When they left that interview room, they could have gone straight home. They'd gotten what they came for. But they were there, so they went on working. Their next interview was with Sean Littlefield, who had gone to Alabama with Gorman. The investigators had high hopes that Gorman would have told him something, since Littlefield was a good enough friend to have gone to Alabama with him and had been on the scene as Gorman was unraveling. But Littlefield didn't have much to offer. Littlefield told them that he and Gorman left for Alabama in Littlefield's car a week before Thanksgiving, driving pretty much straight through, with Gorman doing most of the driving because Littlefield was sick. He said that Gorman's mother called frequently, reporting in one of her earliest calls that Gorman's driver's license was being suspended or revoked. Littlefield described an occasion before they left Maine when Gorman stopped at the Pavilion nightclub, leaving Sean in the car, and went in to ask if they had cameras so he could prove that his car had been there the night he said he'd dropped Amy off. Gorman also checked out the presence of cameras at the Stein Gallery across the street. Littlefield told them that in the beginning Gorman maintained his story that he'd dropped Amy off and that all he'd done that night was kiss Amy. Later, Littlefield said, after the Portland paper reported that the police investigation showed Gorman hadn't dropped her at the Pavilion, Gorman's story changed. Littlefield overheard Gorman on the phone telling a local friend that Cush and Jason had killed her, that he had told them about the spot behind his mother's house, and they had put her there and gone back later to bury her. Littlefield said that Russ did tell him that Amy had been shot in the head, but that Jason and Cush had done it. At that point, no one outside the investigation except the killer knew that Amy had been shot in the head. Littlefield also told them that his former girlfriend, Tiffany, had talked a lot about Gorman and his connection to the case. Tiffany had told people at her school that she knew what had happened and who did it, and that she could get a lot of money from him, Russ, but she wouldn't because she thought he was cute. Littlefield also told them that the first week they were in Alabama, Gorman got a gun, a .25 caliber, that he got a second, similar gun just before the standoff and would sit around and play with the guns. Littlefield told them that when Gorman had to leave his grandmother's house because his uncle was getting out of prison, they were invited to stay with Erica Walker, a family friend. When Young and Heracles finished taping their interview with Littlefield, they turned to the local police department for advice about who else it would be wise to speak with, including local people the two detectives had learned about in their interview with Littlefield. Having let Gorman run, hoping that he'd talk, they now wanted to find the people he might have talked with, friends, relatives, people he'd hung out with, and girls he'd slept with. The cooperation of the Troy Police Department was amazing, another gift in the case. Detective Sergeant Callista Everidge seemed to be on a first-name basis with everyone in town. As Scott Heracles put it, the Everidges were a police family, but they were also members of the community, and they knew their people. Callista Everidge just asked the two visiting detectives who they wanted, took down a list of those people, secured their cooperation, brought them to the station, and marched them, one by one, into the interview room. For Young and Heracles, that generous assistance was another example of the unprecedented bond between police agencies that Amy's case had forged. The next person they interviewed after Littlefield was a long-distance truck driver in her late 30s named Erica Walker, a longtime friend of the family, known to Gorman and others as Mama E. Walker was a rough-edged, tough-talking woman who had her own history with the Troy police, a history revolving around substances like mushrooms and crystal meth. She was an emotional woman, very volatile and unstable. In Heracles's words, sketchy, bouncy, all over the place. She also had a good and valuable story to tell. Walker was another of the witnesses in the case who were deeply pained by the conflict between their belief that they had to tell what they knew, Walker was the mother of a daughter herself, and their sense that in speaking with the police they were betraying a close friend or relative, in Walker's case, this kid that she'd known for most of his life. At first, she was reluctant to talk, expressing concern that either Gorman might come after her or someone who knew him might retaliate against her if she told the detectives what she knew. After Young and Heracles reassured her that Gorman was going to stay in jail and played on her evident desire to cooperate and clear her conscience of what was obviously troubling information, she quickly gave up her reluctance. Danny Young just told her very directly, "Come on, you know you want to tell us." And Young had a way about him that made people trust him. After that, Walker relaxed and agreed to talk. About a week after he had arrived in Troy, Walker told them, Russ was visiting and he said to her, "Mama E, I need to clear my conscience about something." She poured him a cup of coffee and said, "Well, go ahead and talk." He took a deep breath and said, "I did kill that girl up there. We went for a walk and I was tripping and all of a sudden she said something to me that kind of slapped my face and I just went off on her and after I got done with her, I shot her in the head." As Mrs. Walker was talking, Danny Young was thinking, "Boy, I sure hope the tape is working." With all his experience, he still listened with a sense of disbelief at what he was hearing. Even for seasoned detectives, getting information like this is exciting. Their training in interviewing and interrogation really comes into play when they're getting great stuff, and they have to control their emotions, their body language, and their facial expressions so their elation doesn't show. When a breakthrough moment happens, even as the information is coming in, detectives will check and recheck to be sure they're following protocol and that all the equipment is working, always fearful that this vital evidence will somehow be lost. Luckily, everything was working fine for Young and Heracles, and they recorded a second, more detailed version of Gorman's confession than the one he had made to his mother. Gorman told Mama E that after he killed Amy in a fit of rage, he then realized that he had done something wrong, so he cleaned himself up, and he cleaned her up to make sure there was nothing of him left on her, and then he dug a hole and put her in it, hoping that the ground would freeze before they were able to find her. In response to the detective's questions, Walker also told them the following: that Russ told her he had a big 45-millimeter gun at the house and asked if she wanted to see it. That he had walked Amy beside the pond to set the mood. That Russ also told her he had slapped or punched Amy. At one point, he even got down on the floor and demonstrated for Mrs. Walker how he had pinned Amy to the ground and beaten her. That after he had Amy on the ground, he pulled the gun out of the back of his pants and shot her. At one point in the middle of the interview, Mrs. Walker told the detectives she wanted to go outside and smoke. In response to her cooperation, and in order to keep up the good relations, they had let her go, but they sweated bullets until she returned to the interview room, worrying that she might change her mind about talking and leave before she finished the story. She did return to finish the interview. She told the detectives that with respect to women, Russ Gorman was a real whore dog. She'd known him to go with one girl, bring her home, and go right out and get another. Although he never came right out and told Mama E that he'd had sex with Amy, those had been his intentions, and he also assured her that he'd kept himself protected. That later he had burned his clothes and burned Amy's, so there would be nothing of him left at the scene. that when he'd buried her, he had carefully put the grass back, and he hinted about getting rid of a gun by dropping it off a pier. Walker told the detectives that Russ also told all this to his mother, and told his mother why he had done it. What Gorman had told Mrs. Walker meshed with the information Young and Heracles had learned from Amy St. Lawrence's autopsy. It also gave them a better picture of their victim's last moments of life, and of the callous brutality of the man who had assaulted and murdered her, the gunshot, the assault, the carefully replaced clumps of grass, and the missing clothes were all pieces of information only the killer would know. Back in Portland, an exhausted Sergeant Joyce had actually made it to the CID Christmas party, which is where he was when Danny Young called him to report on the Erica Walker interview. Sergeant Joyce grabbed Lieutenant Laughlin and they retreated into a corner while Joyce shared the news. The two of them stood there, stunned by this news of a second confession, as Christmas sounds echoed around them. Everywhere you go, radios, elevators, store speakers are blaring holiday music. Who's got time for Christmas? It's incredible, the amount of work, the stresses and strains of a major case, the tensions between personnel. Do we search? Interview him now? Later? What about? A billion questions are thrown at me, on the phone, with the press, the Attorney General's office, the chief, state police, detectives, the mother's friends, the father, the VWA, victim witness advocate. Dozens of messages await me constantly. The guys are exhausted, and we're worried about Dan and Scott out there on the road. What about the Christmas party? Christmas party? We're working 12-hour days, 20-hour days, running nonstop. But I'm the lieutenant. I should go. At the bar after work, I feel surreal and spacey. People around me talk about normal life, Christmas parties, going to eat, going to shows. I shouldn't have come. I feel so out of sorts here. Everyone is in such an upbeat mood. The tinkles of glasses and silverware mix with laughter. Tommy catches my eye. Something's going on, and I know he needs to talk now. I bring my Manhattan with me as Tommy, parakeeting and jumping, his tie swaying from the movement, backs me into a corner away from the noise. He pauses, giving me that blue-eyed stare. I know he's got something good. Then he starts in, excited, as he tells me, Danny's just called. The guy's got a second confession from Gorman direct to a woman down there. She told them everything. Excitement grips me as I grab Tom's arm and shake him. This is getting good, Tom. I clink my glass against his beer bottle. Yes, I think, yes, we're going to get this guy. It's good news, but it doesn't put me in a party mood. I move through the crowd and out the side door into the street. It's cold and wet, and I'm refreshed to be away from everyone. I'm heading home as soon as I stop at the station. I'm sick of the station. You can't explain the whole process to people. They're thinking, hey, you found her, it's over, when it's just the beginning of a new chapter for us, a new chapter that's getting very interesting. Walker's interview was followed by three more interviews at the Troy police station, including a woman Gorman had slept with who claimed to have had an out-of-body experience in which she saw the whole crime and knew that Gorman was innocent. Two others told the detectives that they had witnessed situations where Gorman had become uncontrollably angry when turned down by a woman. One said Gorman had been driving around with a gun in his lap. All the interviews were videotaped, and Young and Heracles brought those tapes back to Maine. Later in the evening, around 8 p.m., the detectives, accompanied by Detective Sergeant Everidge, went to the home of Gorman's paternal grandmother, Dot Gorman. Although Gorman had boasted to his ex-girlfriend Jamie that his Grammy had plenty of money, it was clear this was a family that was just making do, as evidenced by the fact that although part of the living room floor had collapsed, the residents hadn't fixed it, but were simply walking around the hole. While Heracles took Dot's son, Daniel Gorman, out to the porch and spoke with him, Detective Young interviewed Dot Gorman. She told Young her grandson couldn't have done it and began to cry. Asked if she had ever seen Gorman with a gun, she stated he'd gotten one when he arrived in Alabama, explaining that he needed it because he'd been threatened. Then she related Gorman's story about being threatened by Jason Cook and Kush Sharma. Gorman had told her he knew where Amy St. Laurent's body was only because of the threats and the fact that Jason had asked him where to put a body. It was hard for detectives, even though they knew she was family, and had a difficult time facing the fact that her grandson had committed such a horrific act, to listen to the denials of a woman who had herself sometimes been the victim of Gorman's crimes, to hear, as they so often did, about what a sweet little boy Russ Gorman had been, going to Sunday school and saying his nightly prayers. When Young and Heracles arrived in Troy, they had gone straight to work. They interviewed steadily for about 12 hours, around 11 p.m. Friday night. As the two weary detectives finished their last interview, they realized that they had been so focused they hadn't eaten all day. They also hadn't thought about a place to sleep. Since there weren't many places to stay in Troy, they decided to drive as far as Montgomery, grab some of the fast food that Heracles loved, and find a motel. In Montgomery, revived by food and coffee, Heracles decided he really wasn't all that tired and might as well drive a while. Young agreed, and the two of them, running on only about 4 hours of sleep in the past 36 hours, hit the road again. From the start, these two men had been mission-driven. Now, with their investigation finally going right, they were moving into another realm. A week of getting big breaks, which told them they were going to be able to get a killer off the street, had filled them with excitement and adrenaline. They just wanted to get home and start working with all they'd learned. They never did stop for the night. Combined with their passion for the job was their passion for their families. Heracles was eager to get back to his wife and two small children. Danny Young had a grandchild appearing in a Christmas program on Sunday, and he really wanted to be there. With all that on their minds, the two men figured, what the hell, why not, and kept on driving. On Saturday afternoon at 6 o'clock, Danny Young pulled into his driveway. His wife Linda came out of the house, ready to be mad at him for being so crazy. But it was just Danny Young being, as always, unstoppable, a man who cut himself no more slack than he gave the bad guys, and who believed in honoring his commitments. Young diffused his wife's anger with a tired grin. "Give me a hug," he said, "and welcome me home." Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine, by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.